Karuna Gita put on the poster, Vanaraji will focus on insight into the illusion of self through direct experience and what is possible when we get out of our own way. Gulp. That was my response. Because it is quite difficult to put into words, actually, you know, experiences, direct experiences of insight. It's very difficult to actually talk about. And it's a good idea to talk about it, and it's a really good idea to actually try and nurture our experiences of insight and so on. But it's very difficult to actually put it into words and for the person receiving it to actually really understand what's going on. So I got a quote here from Adyashanti, and I really coincide with what he says. So I'm just going to read this quote. And Adyashanti says, My aim in teaching is to fail. To fail as well as I possibly can. To try to speak the unspeakable is to know from the very beginning that you are going to fail. So my intention is to fail as well as I can at speaking what's not speakable. That's a beautiful quote. And then he continues, even though I can't speak about the whole jewel, I can speak from the place of truth. Then maybe someone listening will hear from that same place. It's not a place that belongs to me. It's a place that's true to what we are. It is that place of knowing. I love that quote, actually. I'll just read again the last bit. It says, even though I can't speak about the whole jewel, I can speak from the place of truth. Then maybe someone listening will hear from that same place. It's not a place that belongs to me. It's a place that's true to what we are. It's that place of knowing. So, I wanted to say something to begin with about that place of knowing. So the journey towards insight is just remembering who and what we are. Remembering what we've always known. I don't know whether the same has happened to you, but I know that the teachings I've come across in Buddhism don't feel like new teachings. It just feels like something that I've always known, but I'd forgotten. So it feels like remembering. So whenever I, people talk about Dharma or I read about the Dharma or whatever, it just feels as if I'm remembering something long forgotten. I remember when I first started coming along to what was the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order then, Tri Ratna, I just wanted to learn to meditate and I didn't want anything to do with Buddhism. Don't talk to me about Buddhism. I just want to learn to meditate, and here I am. And it was because, as I tuned in to what people were saying, I just suddenly thought, actually, that is what I think. It's just that I didn't realise it was called Buddhism. I must have been a Buddhist all my life, but I didn't realise that it was called Buddhism. And I had this, after a few weeks of going, no, thank you, I just had this feeling that I was home. I really felt as if I'd arrived home. And I've always said, it's interesting how we have this idea, we fix ourselves, don't we, through I am this and this sort of person. I've always thought that I'm not an imaginative person. And I'm actually not an imaginative person. You ask me to visualise a blue sky and I can't do it for the life of me, actually. But spontaneously, images come to my mind that I know are coming from a deeper part of myself. And they feel more real than this, you know. They feel more real than than what's solid in front of me. And I remember at that time when I felt that I'd arrived home, this was 28 years ago, I just felt as if I'd been in a maze all my life, going round and round and being a bit lost. And suddenly, somebody, I wasn't out, but somebody had pointed the way out. And there was a lot of freedom in that. So it's to do with intuitively. You know, I always think I'm a cerebral sort of person, that I've been in my head a lot. But that is a view that I have of myself, because I also have a very deep intuitive part of myself too. And all of that I got in touch with, maybe beginner's mind or whatever. So it's just remembering who and what we are. And Sangharakshita has said that faith is something ultimate in us responding to something ultimate in the universe. And that really captures it really well for me. And at the moment, at Mid-Essex, we're going through the Noble Eightfold Path. We've done Perfect Vision. And Bharavadri came and gave a very good talk on Perfect Vision. We've done that. And the thing about Perfect Vision is that we've all had it. We've all had, possibly the reason why we're here, is that we've had a glimpse of what's called Perfect Vision. It's almost like you suspend the chattering mind for a moment, and then what you've been holding down from the ego and the chattering mind has an opportunity to sort of show itself. So examples are, for you know, looking at a beautiful sunset, or I used to live in Epping in a cul-de-sac, and as the moon was coming out, there was this huge orb. It's so big when it first comes up, and then it goes up higher and higher. It's almost like you just stop your natural, you know, way of thinking, your conditioning, your egoic mind, and somehow or other something else comes in. We've all had experiences of perfect vision. And I will say again and again that any experience of perfect vision, we need to nurture it, to actually examine it, to actually reflect on it, because that's the gateway to freedom, actually. And someone once said that those experiences are enlightenment experiences, only they're non-abiding. That those kind of experiences are the experiences that an enlightened being has, but for them, it is an abiding experience. You feel like that all the time. So we mustn't underestimate the experiences that we have of perfect vision. And as you obviously know, it's not about knowing conceptually or intellectually. I was pleased about what you said, actually, that you started off, which we always do, start up here, and somehow or other, if we allow ourselves, something else sort of comes into place. So it's not about knowing conceptually and intellectually. It's a somatic experience. It is an experience in our body. We directly experience it in our bodies. And it's almost like it affects every cell in your body, the bones, the blood. You know, it's almost like a full experience. And that truth lives within all of us. We just need to be receptive to it. And someone once said that a belief is comforting, but it's direct experience that transforms. And I really believe that, actually, that we can think, you know, like, for example, when I started hearing about Buddhism, I just thought, oh, yes, you know, I really resonate with that and so on. But there's no transformation in that kind of comforting belief. It is when you allow yourself to have that direct experience that transforms you and transforms every part of you. So you said that I'm going to talk about insight into the illusion of self through direct experience. So I am going to talk a little bit about direct experience. The problem is, as I've already alluded, is that we think our way through life. We are taught to think, to reify the thinking mind. I've got two sons. One is highly intellectual, and the other one is got a big heart. They were both in the same school, and the one that was valued was the intellectual one. Everybody, and my mother-in-law used to say, to the one that had the big heart, why can't you be more like Richard? And I used to say, don't say that. You know, I just want them to be who they are, you know. But, it's almost like we are taught to value the intellect, and we're very rarely taught to value that direct experience that comes through the body, through the heart, through the emotions. And it's, we think our way through life, and that's what separates us from each other and the truth. So, a little bit about the truth. I mean, the quote says, I can't speak about the whole jewel, I can speak from the place of truth. So a little bit about the truth. And the ultimate truth that Buddhism is pointing at, but so is every other sort of... I know, for example, I've got a brother who's a nuclear scientist. I don't know anything about nuclear physics. I like to say nuclear, you know. But I don't know anything about it. But I know that even that discipline is pointing towards the fact that there is no separation, that there's energy, and we're all part of the same energy. And the truth that Buddhism is pointing at, and I'm sure other religions are pointing at that truth too, is that the separation we experience, that separation that says there's me in here and there's everything else out there, is a delusion that arises from the thinking mind, from the ego it creates. The ego wants to grasp and contain everything it sees. It wants to understand everything. It wants to find meaning through thinking. We need to find a way of calming that obsessive thinking. That's why a big moon or a beautiful sunset or a lovely piece of music actually momentarily calms that obsessive thinking. And that's why we can experience quite a lot of joy and so on, and beautiful qualities. So we do need to find a way of calming obsessive thinking, of calming this need to chase after so many things. So Ryokan, and I'm sure you all know this quote, this poem, Ryokan expresses it beautifully in this poem. His poem is, "My hut lies in the middle of a dense forest. Every year the green ivy grows longer. No news of the affairs of men, only the occasional song of a woodcutter. The sun shines and I mend my robe. When the moon comes out, I read Buddhist poems. I have nothing to report, my friends. If you want to find the meaning, stop chasing after so many things." I love that poem because for me, that poem encapsulates that third precept of purifying one's body through stillness, simplicity, and contentment. Just being with what is, paying attention to the individual things, you know, and just responding in the moment to your direct experience. I love that. Yeah. Yeah, so speaking from that place of truth. So my life, this is where I start talking about my experience a bit, and please have patience with me. And I will be talking about an experience. You know that when you watch the news, not that I watch the news much, and they say the following bit has got flashing lights or whatever. The bit I'm going to talk about in full is a bit shocking, actually, but I hope you're okay with it. So before I talk about that, my life has been one of desperately looking for meaning. All my life I've been, you know, it's almost like I am a greed type, actually, but I wanted to find the meaning. You know, why are we here? What's the point? You know, et cetera, et cetera. And chasing after so many things, actually. When I first came across the Dharma 28 years ago, I was a lecturer, full-time job. I was doing a master's degree at the same time. I had 2 young children, 8 and 10, a husband, a home. We socialized a lot. Why? I just asked myself, why? Why did I do all of that, you know? And then on top of that, I actually thought the Dharma, right? So I was trying to fit in the Dharma into all of that. Crazy. When I look back, I just think it's a crazy existence, actually. Just a crazy, crazy existence. And thank goodness for the Dharma. Thank goodness for the Dharma. Because the Dharma has taught me over the years how to calm it all down. How to calm it all down and make a bit more space in my heart. Space in my heart to hear life whispering in my ear the truth, which is, it's been there all my life, you know. It's just that I've been so busy that I don't hear it. And what happens in my experience is that life is trying to knock very gently to tell you something, and I'm still going there, you know, and I can't hear it. And then it knocks, where's the speaker? It knocks a bit louder, and I still can't hear it because I'm rushing around, and then it goes bang, 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 and I still can't hear it because I'm rushing around too much, and then it goes whack. You're going to listen to it. I mean, there's an agenda. You are going to listen to what life has got to tell you at a particular time. And unfortunately, life has given me quite a lot of whams, actually, because I haven't learned to listen to it. And what I love about the Dharma is the Dharma has allowed me, like Ryokan, to look at the ivy growing and the sun shining and mending the robe. It has calmed it down, not altogether. I accepted to be the chair of Mid-Essex Buddhist Centre. Anyway, a bit more about that later, but yeah. So, yeah. So, that quote says, I can't talk about the whole jewel, I can speak from the place of truth. And it is so important to speak from the place of truth as you experience it. And the more truths that we uncover, we need to embody them, actually. I'd like to stress the importance of actually embodying those truths, those insights. We all have insights, we all have perfect vision, and allowing that to actually influence our lives, because speaking from that place of truth, that has a resonance in the world. So he says, maybe somebody listening will hear from that same place. Yeah, and it's not a place that belongs to me. So the bit that's got flashing lights, beware, is what I'm going to talk about now. What's the time? Yeah, I think. Is that okay? Yeah. So I'd like to talk about a very strong experience that I had on the 24th of December. I've got, you know, specific dates. Yeah, I wrote things in my diary and so on. On the 24th of December 2011, my mother-in-law, in fact, on the 23rd, my mother-in-law, who was 98 at the time, or 2 weeks from being 98, was taken into hospital. She was fine. I mean, she just was finding difficulty in breathing. It wasn't... So she could have had a nebulizer at home, and the doctor said either that, or we can put her in hospital, we can teach her how to use the nebulizer, and then you can take her home and let her use it, actually. So we took her into hospital, and on the 23rd, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I went in the ambulance. But this is all very, very alive for me, actually. And all of a sudden, she was in hospital. We got back home at about 10 o'clock in the evening, and we got a phone call to say, she's not going to last the night, you better come straight back. So we went straight back. We sat in the waiting room, my husband, his brother, and myself. And at about 3 o'clock in the morning, they came in and said, well, actually, she's over the worst. You can sit round the bed now. So the three of us went and sat round the bed. And she was asleep. You know, she was fast asleep. So we were all sort of twiddling our thumbs, looking at each other, you know. So I said to Phil and Paul, go home, go home. I'll stay with her. And if somebody comes at 8 o'clock, and takes over. So it'll be fine. There's no point while she's asleep, us all being round here. So at about 4 o'clock in the morning, she woke up, and the first thing she said is, I'm dying. She was all plumbed in to all these kind of needles, to all these machines, actually, and she woke up, this frail little 98-year-old lady, saying, I'm dying. And we're all hardwired, aren't we, for survival, fight, flight. And what she wanted to do was run, actually, because she knew that she was on her deathbed. So she was desperately trying to get off her deathbed. And she had her hearing aids off, and I couldn't talk to her properly, actually. And she was trying to go off, and I thought she's really going to hurt herself. So she was throwing her legs off, and as I was pushing her legs back on, she was lifting herself up from the bed, and then I was trying to push her back in the bed, and then her leg... This went on for about 20 minutes. There was no nurse there or anything. And I was just... And I was saying to her, you can't get off the bed, because she couldn't hear me. And then she spoke so harshly to me in a way that she never did. She was saying, how dare you? This is my life, and I can do what I want with my life. I want to get off bed, and I want to run, and all this kind of business. And I was really upset, actually, and there was me. She was saying all these things, you know, pushing her back onto the bed. It was really difficult, and then eventually, after about 20 minutes, a nurse walked past, and I said, help. And then she took over, and she was still trying to fight the nurse. And eventually, she just ran out of energy, and she fell asleep. Part of me was thinking, thank goodness that Phil and Paul weren't witnesses to that, because that's her mum, that's their mum, actually. So I was thinking, well, I'm glad it was me that witnessed that, not them. And then Paul came at 8 o'clock, and I said she was a bit distressed during the night, but I didn't say much more. And then she died at 3 o'clock that afternoon. And what it did for me is it left me with a kind of a horrified anxiety. And at the same time, Shubha and I used to run the women's class at the London Buddhist Centre, and we were giving a series of talk on the Mahaparinirvana Sutta, which is the, you know, the last 3 months of the Buddha's life, the death of the Buddha. And after witnessing, I was quite horrified that she couldn't let go at the point of death. It's almost like there was this heart, and this frail little old lady, I don't know where she got. I couldn't keep her on the bed. She had more strength than I had. And it suddenly made me realise, oh my goodness, you know, such a strong urge, isn't it? That will to, that kind of will to survive or whatever. And because I was preparing a talk for the London Buddhist Centre on the Mahaparinirvana Sutta, I'm reading the Mahaparinirvana Sutta, and the Buddha says, oh, it's time to die. I'm dying. It's time to put the will to live down. Let's put the will to live down. No big deal. So I had these two examples by my side, actually, and I was just thinking, oh, goodness, you know, I know where I'd like to be at the point of death, you know, more like the Buddha rather than that. But it meant, actually, that I spent the whole of 2012 in a kind of a very difficult space. We don't talk about a soul, actually, in Buddhism, but it was almost like some of the Christian mystics talk about the dark night of the soul. And it felt as if that year was a complete dark night of the soul for me. And I went into a deep, deep, deep despair, to the extent that I thought I couldn't hold it. But quite fortunately, Kamala Sheela was holding Mondays at the London Buddhist Centre for order members, and I was on the team, so we were bringing all sorts of different people to talk, and it was all talking about insight, actually, which was fantastic. And Vajra Chedika helped me a lot. He kept saying, don't push it away, stay with it. And I was saying, but there's this deep despair. And he was saying, just turn towards it, accept it, don't push it away. It's almost like I fell to pieces. I fell into a million pieces. And I think it was the march that wasn't the Tate Modern had an exhibition on Picasso. And I saw this painting. It's only very small here. I mean, it's bigger. It's The Weeping Woman. And I went to that Picasso exhibition and saw this picture, And I suddenly thought, that's me. It's almost like the hat and the hair, you know, the elegant hat and the hair is holding the woman together. But she was in pieces. There's all these tears coming out. And I was just thinking, that's me. I'm in pieces. And what I would have done previously is to, you know, there's that expression, isn't it? Pull yourself together, isn't it? I would have done in the past, just actually pulled all the pieces together in the same old way and just carried on. But I decided, because friends were actually helping me and actually saying, just stay with it, stay with it, stay with it. A deep, dark night of the soul, totally in despair. I was completely in a bit of a black hole. And then about two-thirds of the way through the year, around about the October, because I kept on turning towards this despair, I had this very strong feeling that it wasn't my despair. It was just despair flowing through me. And it became not personal. So it wasn't a personal thing. I had a very, very strong experience that it wasn't personal to me, that despair. It was just despair. But we feel joy, we feel despair, or whatever. It just, that was a very strong, and Vajracchedika picked up on it and he said, oh, that's very interesting. And did you feel that it was not a personal thing? You know, so I'm quite grateful to Vajracchedika, actually, because he did support me quite a lot through all of that. Yeah. But I continued with the despair, feeling the dark night of the soul or whatever. I wrote in my diary on the 31st of December. This is extraordinary, actually, the way things happen. On the 31st of December 2012, I wrote in my diary, what was I supposed to learn from Doris' death? Doris, my mother-in-law. And that was on the 31st of December 2012. On the 3rd of January 2013, I've got a friend called Satchika, and for about 18 or 19 years, at the end of the year or the beginning of the next, we always look back at the year just gone and look forward as to what we need. It's like a spiritual resolution, you know, what do we need to work on now? And I have found that extremely helpful. And during that review, I suddenly realized that my horrified anxiety about my mother-in-law wasn't that she couldn't let go at the point of death. And she couldn't let go at the point of death, and that was a fact. But that's not what put me into a horrified anxiety. What I realized is that it wasn't her, it was me that I couldn't let go. So it became really clear to me, it's nothing to do with her, it's me not being able to let go. So, am I still alright for time? I'm nearly there. I'm going to say a few more bits, but yeah, so that weekend of the 4th to the 6th of January, I went on a weekend retreat with Vajracchedika. I think some of us, I think we all, did you not go on that weekend retreat? Quite a few of my chapter went. And Vajracchedika was actually saying on that weekend that we really need to look at our deepest needs and longings. And that really spoke to me, actually. So I had realised that I couldn't let go, and I'd asked myself, what is it that I can't let go of, actually? I didn't, on that third with Satchika, I just realised I couldn't let go, but I wasn't sure what I couldn't let go of. I went on that weekend retreat, and then on the Monday, I thought, well, I'll do a writing exercise. Vajracchedika was encouraging us to look at our deepest need and longing. So I started writing, and I know, it's interesting, because I know all of this, I've known all my life, actually, but it's almost like I knew it in my blood, in my bones, in my cell. And that is, I started, you know, my deepest need and longing is to be loved and accepted. And it was like a flowers opening, you know, the petals of a flower opening up. As soon as I acknowledged that, the next layer came out, and that was fear. And it was all somatic. I was just experiencing. It was such a strong somatic experience. So the next experience was this deep, deep fear. And the fear went something like, I'm not good enough. no, I don't have a voice, nobody loves me, I'm, you know, I'm ostracized, I'm pushed aside. You know, there's a fear that I would never be accepted, I would never be loved and accepted. So I wrote about that, really fully embodying that. The next layer up was the mask that I put to the world. The mask I put to the world is keeping all of that down, and in my world of work, etc., I've worked so hard to actually be efficient and competent and hardworking, and people recognising that, you know, I can do things, and, you know, in some place I thought that I'd be loved and accepted by doing that. It wasn't a conscious thing. But it is a mask that I put to the world, actually, that when I have a role, I can be all these things. And then the next layer up, it was like, you know, layer upon layer, I felt this unbearable tension in my body. It was like the whole of the body was actually just holding on. It was a horrible tension. And that tension was something, went something like, I know, I was ordained at that time, that life is impermanent, that things change, etc., but not this. Not this. I have a fixed view that I'm not good enough, that everybody's better than me, that nobody's going to love and accept me, that, you know. And I've been it was that tension, holding all of that stuff. And I can feel it now, actually. So I turned towards that, I really accepted that. And then the next layer up was an addiction. I just knew that there was a kind of an addiction, just like drug addiction or addiction to cigarettes or whatever, an addiction to a fixed self-view. I knew I was addicted to this view that says, I'm not good enough, nobody's going to love me. Why? It's conditioning, isn't it? It's conditioning. So it was a really strong experience, and it was almost like, do you remember that program that used to say, this is your life? It was almost like, this is your ego. In a book, you know. Yeah, and it was almost like the ego edifice shattered and collapsed. And then that was on the Monday. On the Thursday, I went to the women's class, and Pranaya Devi was actually leading the class. And she said, bring to mind a Buddha or a Bodhisattva that you connect to. So I immediately thought about my Yidam, which is Vajrasattva. So I started visualising Vajrasattva. And then with bells, whistles, you know, drums, a roll of drums, comes in Amitabha. Amitabha elbows his way in. Bang! And I, you know, it was almost like a succession. I just laughed out loud, actually. I was just thinking, I don't need to be loved and accepted. I am love. And that was the message I was getting from the appearance in such an spectacular way of Amitabha. So, but I spent about 6 months not knowing what had happened, actually. I just didn't understand what all, I knew that something, it was almost like I was so disoriented. And there were three of us leading this, Kamala Sheila was on sabbatical, and three order members were actually leading the Monday classes. And I kept going back trying to talk about this until one of them said, I think she thought that I was getting a bit of Alzheimer's or something, you know. Vanaraji, you've told me that 5 times, you know. But it was almost like I just needed to express it because I just didn't know what had happened. I just didn't know what to do with the experience. And it was just shattering. You know, it was a complete shattering of my old self, but I didn't know what had happened. Luckily, da-da, the cavalry comes along. On the 22nd of July, 2013... We invited Karuna Gita, Vimala Sara, Satchapala, and Amarigita, yeah. The four of you came to talk about direct pointing. And we had a day where they were talking about direct pointing and a course that one can do on direct pointing. And I am quite intuitive, and I felt I need to do that. That's my next step. That's what I need to do. And you all presented that so beautifully. And I noticed such a change in Vimala Sara. She used to be in my chapter, and I was, well, you know, I didn't connect with Vimala Sara in the way that I connected on that day. I could see a huge change in her. I'm mentioning names and it's being recorded, but anyway. And then I spoke to Vimala Sara, and she said, oh, I can get you my guide, because you know, this course is you get a guide, and then that guide, it's extraordinary, really, because they guide you through your experience moment by moment, every single day, for about a month. And he went on a walking holiday in Italy. And I said, well, let's, 3 weeks. And I said, well, let's put no. And he found an internet cafe every single day while he was doing his walking holiday in Italy. And he was actually saying, what is this? Where is it coming from? What's your direct experience, etc.? Until at the end of that month, I actually realized that what had happened to me, what I had to learn from Dora's death, was that I needed to let go of that fixed self-view that I'd created through my conditioning. It's not real. It's not real. Anyway, it was, And through that direct pointing course, I was able to understand the process, and the realization that I came to was that the search for meaning in life is a surrogate for the knowledge that we are life. It was quite a turnaround. It was quite extraordinary. So I feel that experience of staying and staying for a whole year with that dark night of the soul, with that despair, etc., it helped me see through the illusion of self. Don't get me wrong, I knew all of that all my life, but it's almost like seeing it as if for the first time, a little bit like the Buddha's four sights. I'm sure you know about it. Does anybody not know about the Buddha's four sights, where he saw an old man and a sick man and a deaf man? And the myth says that it was like the first time he'd seen an old man or a sick man or whatever. But I don't think it's that. It's that you suddenly see the implications of a particular way of looking at life. And that's what happened to me. I was just thinking, I have a choice here. I can either continue making myself and other people suffer through thinking that I am that fixed self, not good enough, not, you know, everybody, nobody loves me, you know, all this kind of poor me stuff, or I could be something else. And that we all have that choice. And it's almost like, you know, if I go in that route, it's more and more suffering for me and other people. If I go down this route, there's freedom and joy, etc. So, you know, it made me realize, well, how long am I going to continue doing that? So seeing through the illusion of self was a very important thing for me, but I still have such a long way to go. Such a long way to go. They talk about, once you see through the illusion of self, you still have 7 lifetimes to go. I mean, of course, there is no time or space. We're out of time and space when you talk about the transcendental, but it just goes to show the amount of work that still needs to be there. If you talk about 7 rebirths, and if you think that you live 80 years in one life, that's 560 years. Oh my goodness. It makes me, when I put it in those terms, actually, I think I just want to work harder and harder and harder at, just getting deeper and deeper into the insight that the Buddha has given us through the Dharma. So it doesn't mean, it was quite interesting, because that was around about September, and I went to Valencia with my friend Amritamati and Siddhishri, celebrating Amritamati's 50th birthday. And I'd broken through this idea that I am this particular fixed self. And at one point, we were late for a restaurant, and of course Siddhishri and Amrita Mati are much younger and much slimmer than me, and they were walking really fast ahead of me, talking to each other. And it's almost like the same old feelings. They're leaving me out, nobody loves me, I'm being left out. The same thing washed through me. But then I had a choice. I had a choice, actually. I suddenly thought, that isn't true. I've seen through that. That isn't real. So then I chose to put that down and to actually just say, they love me. They wouldn't have invited me to Valencia if they didn't love me. You know? And it was interesting because I could have gone down that route and I chose not to. I chose to actually just say that isn't true because then I suffer and I make them suffer, you know, all that kind of stuff. There's still so much work to do, you know. The greed, the hatred, the delusion that we have is still, but it was so freeing to actually be able to put down that fixed self-view that I've held for so long. It was almost like I now have a choice. I'm not automatically reacting, but I'm responding. I have a choice. I am witnessing what's going on, actually. It feels a little bit like you've got this stage and there's all this drama going on and I'm the curtain, you know, the backdrop. And I'm just watching all this kind of stuff going on there. And I'm just observing it without getting too caught up in it. I think I'll leave it there. There was a bit more I wanted to say, but maybe we can incorporate that into what we're going to do after the tea break. So the remit... No, I want to say something else, actually, because the remit was, Vanaraja will focus on insight into the illusion of self through direct experience, and what is possible when we get out of our own way. And it's very interesting because I was so into direct experience, even to the extent that I became a guide on Tejananda's course. And I moved to Chelmsford 3 years ago in July, and Upechdi kept saying, let's set up a Buddhist centre, let's set up a Buddhist centre. And I was saying, no, absolutely, that's not what I want to do with my life. No, thank you. I wanted to direct pointing, etc. And she kept going on, and I kept saying, no, that's not what I want to do. Forget it, you know. And then I gave a talk, and there's this young woman called Hannah. And after the talk, she came to me in tears, and she actually said to me, I really connected with what you said. Can we talk about it, please? Because I find it really hard. And it's an intuitive response. I don't have them that often, but it was an intuitive response to say, it isn't actually what I want. It's what's required. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I just suddenly thought, my intuition was, it was so clear that that's what I needed to do. So I said yes, and whooshed, Mid-Essex Buddhist Centre has come into existence in a way that has been unprecedented by me, actually. It's almost like it was just waiting for somebody to take up that challenge, because it's almost like all the pieces have come together in one could say miraculous ways, but it isn't. It's almost like the Dharma Niyama, and I'm not going to go into that if you haven't heard of the Dharma Niyama, but it's almost like the Dharma Niyama has actually just said, okay, you're putting the effort in, let's go that way. And it has been, and I have a strong conviction, actually, that I am in the right place, that everything I've done in my life was pushing me in this direction. And I am actually doing exactly what I need to do with my life. And I think what is possible, which is your remit, what's possible when we start to get out of our own way, it's almost like up here I was saying, absolutely not, Mid-Essex, forget it. And I kept taking it to the chapter, and they kept saying, you know, all this business. And I wasn't listening to that gentle knock. It was almost like, I want to do direct point, I want to do, you know, all this business. And it was going knock, 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 until it became quite evident. So what I'm learning to do is to listen to those gentle knocks and follow. Sometimes I get it right, sometimes I don't get it right. But what I notice in being chair of the Mid-Essex Buddhist Centre is that I'm really glad that I did this direct pointing course, that I saw through the illusion of self. It's still there, of course it's still there. I haven't got rid of it. But it's almost like I know it's an illusion, because if there's anything that would be an ego trip, it could be so, if I hadn't done this, being a chair of a Buddhist centre would have been such an ego trip for me, you know, because, and it isn't. It isn't. I want to get out of the way. I don't want it to be anything to do with me. I just want the transcendental to be able to be expressed in Mid-Essex, in Southwood and Ferrers, through a bit of effort that perpetually myself and others are actually putting in into Mid-Essex. And I'm really glad, because it's got nothing to do with my ego. It's not an ego trip for me at all. It is just doing what I know needs to be done. It's not what I want, it's what needs to be done. I leave it there. Okay? Thank you.